Well, let me welcome everyone who's here this morning. We do have a number of people here. We have visitors. We're glad you're here. We hope you will want to come back and be with us again in the future. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that we have several people with us that have not been able to be with us. And Sister Maria is back again this morning. Mary is able to be here this morning. And Brian is with us. And that's a real blessing to have all of them together with us. All of them, of course, they're various situations have kept them away from us, but they're in our hearts, they've been in our prayers, and they will continue to be so. And we're just glad to have them all here this morning, and everybody else. It's a good morning, a beautiful morning, and it's a blessing for us all to be together. I want to make mention that I did put out some upcoming events on the bulletin board. There is a movie night coming up, those of you that might be interested in that. And also a game night for the adults, young adults. So take notice of those dates, if you will. We appreciate that. Without any further delay, we're going to kick off the second quarter. We are talking about this year, fulfilling my purpose. And we've been looking at different areas. We'll mention those in just a moment. And this quarter, we're going to be talking about fulfilling my purpose in my home. I'll come back to the theme verse that I've got listed up here. But let's... There it goes. Let's notice, I hope, let's notice what we're talking about and going to be talking about. Our theme, of course, is fulfilling my purpose. We're devoting really considerable public teaching, both the sermons. I'm preaching a lot of sermons. Wes is preaching some sermons. Others may be doing that throughout the year. And our classes, especially the adult classes, a lot of them are geared toward fulfilling my purpose. We are talking about these four areas. We're talking about the church. We did that last quarter. Fulfilling my purpose in the church. This quarter, we will be talking about fulfilling my purpose in the home. And then we'll, in the third and fourth quarter, we'll talk about the workplace and even our recreational activities. But as we look at these areas, our goal is for each individual here, each individual, to focus attention on his or her place. And I'm going to use that terminology a lot this quarter. My place in my home. And it is very specific. God has a lot to say about it. And then our home, in turn, and I will say a good bit about this morning, our home in society. So if each of us fulfills our place and does a good job at that, and we have a strong home, then our homes, in turn, help society as a whole. So we're talking about throughout this year. Now, let me mention a phrase that I'll touch upon from time to time. A phrase that has been a popular song. It's been a Hollywood movie, although I'm not sure how much it had to do with the ancient sentiment. But a popular song, a Hollywood movie, and it's even the adornment of a lot of refrigerators, the copy of which you see up here. Home is where the heart is. I want you to think about that phrase for a moment. I'll make mention of it again, and as I said, throughout the quarter, I'm going to come back to this idea. But home is where the heart is. This is actually a very ancient quote. It's attributed to Pliny the Elder from the mid-first century. So we're talking about something that's a quote almost 2,000 years old. This idea of where your heart is, that's your home, or home is where the heart is, as we say it in English. So let's talk about our heart being where our home is, or our home being where our heart is. Our theme verse for the year is Luke 12 and verse 34, in which Jesus said, where your treasure is, when you treasure something, when you place high value upon something, there your heart will be also. Now, for many of us, that certainly describes our home. When we look at our home, we would say our home is a great treasure. I know I would. I trust that Montel and Juliet feel that same way about our home. And I trust that there are many people that are gathered here today who feel that way. Do I treasure my home? Remember, we talked about this last quarter, and we talked about things such as value. We talked about things such as priority. We talked about things such as withdraw upon our emotions, our feelings, our thoughts, that a lot of time and effort is devoted towards something, and that really defines what a treasure is. It describes how we view a treasure. Well, do I treasure my home? Not all people in this world do. In fact, I would say that many people consider home to be the worst place there is. And I've known that, and very close to home, to, if you'll pardon the pun. But do I treasure my home? And as we go further with that, is that where my heart really is? Is my heart in my home? You know, that's not true of everyone. I would dare say there are many, many people today, for example, many men, many women, who have a home, and yet their heart is with someone else that's not part of their home. And that's a very sad situation. So is that where my heart is? Is that truly where I find my purpose, or at least a great part of my purpose? When I think of myself and I think of my talents and abilities and my place in life, my role that I fill, etc., does it involve the home in to a great degree? Do I really, in the forefront of my mind, think of myself as a husband, a father, etc., and you as you fulfill your place in your home? But wherever my purpose is, that usually is where my heart is and what I treasure in life. So as we look at this, do I treasure my home? How important is it? We're going to talk about that throughout the quarter. But let's go all the way back to the beginning. From the beginning, and I'd like for you to turn to the opening two chapters of Genesis. I'm going to spend the majority, I may veer away from it briefly and come back, but I'm going to spend really the rest of the lesson on these two chapters. And there's several things I want to say about it. Because from the beginning, God established the very basic unit of society. Now that may be a high-toned way of looking at Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, but I think if you look closely at it, that's exactly what you see. Society begins with the creation of man and woman. Man was brought forth in God's own image. And I'm going to borrow from TJ. I already told him I would do this, but I thought it was an excellent point last week. So, after his kind. I agree with that wholeheartedly. The idea of God creating us in His image means that we are born, if you will, after God's own kind. And in turn, God would have us to reproduce in that manner. But the ideas of home and family. Now, I like to watch a lot of these programs on the History Channel and Discovery Channel. My wife and daughter know that. And I like these shows, and I like them for a lot of different reasons. It doesn't mean I agree with everything. And especially when you begin to talk about the ideas of evolution and how man, you know, really as a pack of animals began to slowly come to this idea of having separate homes and they being units within a society, a culture, etc. The whole idea of family, where they didn't just have children reproducing like animals do and still running in a pack, but really the idea of the family with man and woman, husband and wife, and children, those ideas did not evolve over time. Read with me in Genesis 1, look at verse 26. We see them established by God Himself from the very beginning. And God said, "Let us make man in our image." Now this is humanity. This is a word for humanity or humankind. "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And let them," that is humanity, "have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over the cattle," or animals that roam the earth, "and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God, verse 27, created man, humanity again, human beings, in His own image. "In the image of God created He them," or "He him, male and female created He them." Now when you look at those verses, you see the repetition there. And any time you see that in Old or New Testament, but especially this Hebraistic idea in the Old Testament of repeating, 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 it is to stress, to emphasize. It would be like when we underline things or put them in italics sometimes or bold them or whatever it might be. Because we really want to drive home a point. God created man. And God created man in His very own image to be like Him. Man is inescapably like God in many respects, even though we may refuse God and we may squelch Romans 1 or suppress that nature that God has given to us Yet even the worst of humanity cannot escape the fact that he is still created in God's image. And there will be things within him or her that are still like God, regardless of how much he has suppressed the nature of God. We are the offspring, as Paul said, of God. And God blessed them, verse 28. And I'm of the view that one of the greatest blessings in life is this idea of family. Now, I've known people, let's be honest, I've been people, okay, that looked at home as one of the greatest curses that there is. The fact you had to be part of a family, and especially the fact that you had to be part of a family with all of the drama, we would say today, and I used to use some other choice terms for it, but the fact that you had to be part of a family with all of that is certainly no blessing. And yet I have come to realize what God meant for us to have and how great a blessing that truly is. When a father sits up late at night because his wife has done it night after night and she's so tired she can't even hardly get herself up out of bed, and the father says, no, honey, you rest tonight, and takes that crying, screaming, hungry baby and goes down and begins to rock it late at night, in the middle of the night. Some of you here can well relate to that, even recently. But begins to rock that child and sees the child, you know, calm down and be full and be sated, be happy. And the father looks down at that child and the beauty and the innocence and the perfection in that child. What a blessing that is. When a man and a woman grow old together, and all the things that have happened, all of the things that have transpired, all the battles they've gone through, the sicknesses, the wars even, that they've fought together, and they look at each other, he looks at her, she looks at him, and to the world they're old and wrinkled and, you know, falling apart. And to each other they are the most beautiful people that the world has ever known. What a blessing that is. When a father and mother look at a child and see a child grow up and mature and take their own place in life and even, yes, leave them and begin a new home, and that feeling they have inside of accomplishment, of wonder, just of the excitement of it all, what a blessing that is. God blessed them. And we could go on and on and on with that. Family is meant to be a blessing. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply and replenish or fill up the earth with my kind, is what God is saying. Fill up the earth with people like me, like I made you, and let them have dominion over the fish of the earth, or the fish of the sea, and the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. God established the home. God blessed that institution and with his first commandment told man and woman to have children bearing after their kind and those who would be in the image of God. And that's why Proverbs 22 and verse 6, and we know the verse very well, train up a child in the way he should go. The way he should go is the way of God. Train him up in the way he should go and he will profit, she will profit, you will profit, and of course I'm paraphrasing, but that's the idea. And the whole world will be blessed and better for it. Now, as we look at Genesis 1 and 2, it's a pivotal passage. There are so many precedents that are established with the creation of man and woman, and as we're about to read and look at in Genesis 2, their subsequent marriage. For God married them. He didn't just create them and let them run free as animals within the Garden of Eden. He married them and established from the very beginning the unit of the home. So let's look at that for a moment. Let's look at Genesis chapter 2. And again, you've got this repetition. Some of us that were at the Wendy's class on Thursday night, and the guy yelled at us, you know, some of you know exactly what I'm talking about there. If not, ask some of the Wendy's people. They'll tell you about it. And he yelled at us, and he didn't understand that this is a Hebraistic way of repeating for emphasis. God said, he created man. And just like we do sometimes, let me go back and be specific, God says. Let me tell you exactly how I made man and woman. He took some dust of the ground. We're going to talk more about that later in the quarter. And he made man. And then verse 18, man, that is male, was alone. Adam was alone. And the Lord said, verse 18, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a help that is meet, fit, suitable, comparable to him. And I'll bring her to him is the idea. So out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called them, of course, that was their name. And Adam gave names to all the animals, to all the cattle, to the fowl of the air, to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a help that was meet for him. No animal can take the place of a woman. And it is what a woman, it is a woman that is fitting, if you will, that is comparable to a man. It's two parts of the whole, and we're about to see that. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep, verse 21, to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs, or literally from his side, and he closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from man made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. Again, we'll talk about these terms a little later in the quarter. They are important in themselves. But let's stay with the story here. He made a woman and brought her to the man. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, or literally she was taken out of man. And that's what woman means, out of man. And then, like Jesus quoted in relation to marriage, verse 24, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother. Now, if Jesus quoted this in relation to marriage, this is what Jesus meant by it from the beginning. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave or be joined. Literally, when Jesus repeated it in Greek, he said, and be glued to his wife. And they shall be one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Now, there are a number of precedents, as we said, that are established by this. Let me run through them very quickly. A man shall leave his father and his mother. Again, you see the picture there. Mother, father, children. But here is the child leaving the home. A man shall leave his father and his mother. A family unit, a home, consists of a man married to a woman. And, of course, the children they bring forth. So, in the end, you have a family unit. You have a home. Mother, father, children. Those are all parts of a home. And they begin, of course, many times with a single person, and they develop into this full family unit. But that is the basic unit of the home. A man leaves his father and his mother. He starts his own home. And there's to be an inseparable bond between two people when they do marry. They are bound by God. Notice, even in Genesis 2, the Lord made the woman and brought her to the man. This is God bringing them together. Just as much as when we stand before a preacher or a justice of the peace or a boat captain, someone with the authority that's vested by the state to marry people, yes, we obey the laws of the land. Yes, we get that marriage license in our country. But the marriage is constituted when God binds them together, inseparably. And so they are bound. And any child they have will someday leave that home, leave that mother and father, and be joined or cling to or adhere, be glued to his or her spouse, and a new home is established. Marriage, then, as we look at that as the basic foundation, if you will, of the home, marriage is one man for one woman for one life. And that's what we see from the beginning in Genesis 2. And yet, in our society, notice what's happening. Since 1960, approximately 85% of people in the United States are in 1960, maybe I should say it like that. In 1960, about 85% of people were married, but there's been a steady decline in marriage since. I want you to look at an alarming statistic. This is a graph of 1960 to 2010. Now, those were the latest figures that I could find. And they may be taken every 5 years, so it's maybe about to come out again. But these are government statistics and a graph just showing marriage. In 1960, notice that about 85% of people married. That's what people did. A man found a woman found a man in this country, and they married. Notice how, in those two lines, The blue line represents people who have a high school education or less. The green line, you'll notice, which has now crossed the blue line, shows people who have a bachelor's degree or more. In fact, the truth is in our nation that even though both are declining, educated people tend to marry in greater amounts than uneducated. That may be surprising to some and not so to others. But the alarming thing, you will see that of educated people, it is fast approaching only half of them will ever marry. And of people who have a high school degree or less, it is fast approaching 40%. People just do not marry anymore. Now, as we go further with that and we look at Genesis chapter 2, notice what we see there, though. We see man and woman married by God. He brought the woman to man. A man leaves his father and mother, cleaves unto his wife. They are one flesh. Notice verse 25. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. There's no shame in that arrangement. It is something that's instituted by God, designed by God. But if we look at Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, what we see there is that the marriage bed is undefiled, but all other arrangements are not. They are defiled. They are less than God wants. It may be acceptable in our society for people to engage in sexual activity, have children outside of marriage, and that may be commonplace. But it was never what God intended. And it is not what God sanctions. And there is no accounting for time. In other words, a person could not have said back to Moses, "Hey, dude, this is 1445 B.C. Now, I'm being a little facetious, but that would have been the point. Moses would have written this literally thousands of years after God said it, after God instituted it. The point is, time does not change it. But I ask you a question. The statistics don't lie, and we all understand that. We look around and we see people that are not married. Is society better for it? I mean, really, is society better for it? Men, women, and children. I'll give you another statistic. Did you know that the lifelong projected probability, you know, we have a lot of young people here, a lot of you are going to be married soon, in the case of some of you that are here, looking to be married soon, in the case of others, wanting to be married, in the case of others. Do you know that the lifelong projected probability of a marriage ending in divorce, that is, you go into the marriage knowing that these are the odds you have to beat, between 40 and 50%. It wavers a little bit, but that's been pretty steady for almost 40 years. That the chances are your marriage will last your whole lives, both of you alive, is only between 40 and 50%, not even half of the marriages. That's the odds that we go against in this day and time. So when we begin to talk about, and we will, the idea of choosing well, and the idea of putting forethought into it, not just quote-unquote jumping into marriage and all of that, that's why. Because it is easily, cheaply, and generally without consequence that you can go and get a divorce. Drive around the city, and I know you've all seen them. There are billboards everywhere that will tell you for less than $500, sometimes less than $400 or even $300, you can get a divorce. And no one really thinks anything about it. It's just commonplace in our society to talk about your quote-unquote ex, be that married or not. It's just an accepted fact of life. And no fault, no consequence in it. Where once there had to be a viable reason to dissolve a marriage. You had to abandon your spouse or commit adultery against your spouse or something like that. Now it is just no fault. Just get a divorce because you want to get a divorce. I just don't want to be married anymore. Is society better for that? Ask yourself that question. A person might say, well, yeah, I want to be able to get out of the marriage if I'm in one and I don't like it. Is society better for that? Who really suffers in a society with no consequences? Because that's where we are. I mean, virtually, we're in a society of no consequences. So who suffers? Well, let me throw up one statistic, and I'll tell you, from personal experience who suffers. I do. Okay? And if you're part of this, so do you. And I will suffer the rest of my life because of this. Because you see, there's been virtually a death of marriage in this society, in our society. And if you go back, not even 100 years ago, do you realize that about 96% of children were born and grew up with mom and dad? Now, sometimes disease or war or something took that away, but those were the exceptions. But 96% of children born to married people, and now that's less than 60%. In other words, over 4 out of 10 children walking around were not born to parents who had committed to one another in marriage. Who suffers in a society with no consequences? The core of society depends on the home. It is the basic building block to fill up the earth. That's the way God designed it. That's what God meant. And when that model breaks down, so does society. I want to suggest three things to you very quickly, and I will come back to these in later lessons. Let's talk about the marriage between the man and the woman. Men and women suffer when marriage dies in a society. And they suffer for the lack of commitment due to covenant. Because they don't understand the idea of covenant. Maybe an arrangement, a convenience, etc. But it's no longer a covenant, a commitment. And so we trade as men and women. We trade trust, trusting each other. We trade dependency. I can depend on that person. We trade permanency. I know Montel will be there, no matter what. We trade that. We trade security. We trade the security I have and knowing I have a wife, she has, and knowing she has a husband. We trade that. So do our children, obviously. But we trade that. And we trade it for pleasure and convenience. Who suffers? Children. Children suffer because they lack the stability of the home. When children grow up and they have a home as a quote-unquote stable environment, it prepares them for life. It enables them for life. It gives them that foundation upon which to build their life. And when they don't have it, they don't have that solid foundation, they suffer. And finally, society suffers. It suffers the effects. For all it may trumpet the idea of how free we are, and how we've thrown off the shackles of antiquated ideas and notions like marriage. You'll hear that out of Hollywood people and professional people and so forth. You will hear that. But for all that we trumpet in saying that, what do we have? And I'll tell you what we have. And these statistics do not lie. Crime has escalated. You know, it's amazing that in direct proportion to the death of marriage, that graph that went straight down, crime went straight up. Directly proportional to it. There's got to be a relation there. Psychological problems. Direct proportion. As the graph goes down with marriage, psychological problems go up. There's got to be a relation there. People become poorer, not richer. You would think you're free, you have no responsibilities. Your money is yours. You should be richer, right? People are poorer. And they're less productive. And sometimes I'm inclined to think, you know, that the motivation that I know, the days that I don't feel good, that a headache is rocking me or whatever it might be, and I drag myself out of bed and I go to work. And I say to myself, every time, I've got a family. It's a motivation to produce, to be productive, to do something with your life. The fabric of society, the home, disintegrates as the home disintegrates. Every single society there has ever been that lost the home as the basic unit has failed. And there's not one exception in history to that. If you're here this morning and you're not a child of God, This has not been a lesson so much about obeying the gospel as it is about living. For the practical part of living the life of a Christian is to buy into God's ideas, even about basic things like home and family. We're going to talk a lot this semester, or this semester. Yeah, I'm still in school mode. But we're going to talk a lot this quarter. Yeah, I never get away from that, you know. But we're going to talk a lot about the home and family. We're going to talk about our society and taking our place in it. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, but you believe in Jesus, and you'll confess that faith, and you're willing to change your life and live your life as He wants you to live it, in your home, everywhere. And this morning you'll be baptized, your sins will be washed away. And if you're here this morning and you are a child of God and your life has not been everything it needs to be, and you want to ask for the prayers of the people here and kind of make a new start, I suppose that this is a great day for doing that. Won't you please come while we stand and sing?